David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement, and you're listening to The Game Changers, Episode 4, Trainspotting, Part 2. In Part 1, I told you the story of the birth of the train game genre, and how for the first 30 years of its existence, it developed a small but fanatic following of anoraks, or train spotters, who just loved to play games about 19th century railroad empires and stock manipulation. Now, in Part 2, I'll tell the story of the person who found the key to opening up the rather dusty room of train games and letting millions of people in. And his name is Alan R. Moon. Like Francis Tresham, the inventor of 1829, Moon was English by birth, but Moon moved with his family to America at 14. After serving in Vietnam in the U.S. Air Force, he went to college to study English and theater. In his senior year, he met Don Greenwood, one of the senior designers at Avalon Hill, and also the editor of its in-house magazine, The General, which in those pre-internet days was a very influential informational and communications hub in the hobby games industry. Greenwood hired Moon in 1979 as assistant editor with the idea that Moon would eventually take over the editing job at The General. Moon turned up on his first day at work and was shown into an office with a typewriter and not much else. No one gave him any other work to do. For 2 weeks, Moon waited for someone to tell him what to do. Then he decided he'd better go find something to do before he got in trouble. He stumbled into a couple of offices full of unplayed prototypes and asked Greenwood if he could take a look at them. Greenwood said, "Sure, go for it. Figure out which ones are good." So, instead of assistant editor, Moon became a game developer, helping to bring games like Fortress Europa and War and Peace to the market. After 4 years, Moon moved to Parker Brothers to develop video games. Unfortunately, the first boom in video games ended shortly thereafter, as did his job, and by 1984, Moon was designing board games again, this time freelance. Alas, the kind of games he was designing were not like mainstream games, and publishers weren't interested. One of his prototypes for a game called Airlines sat with Mattel for a year and was returned to him with the only comment being that they found the rules too complicated. Finally, in 1990, he managed to sell Airlines to a German publisher, Abacus Spiele. It was his frustration with mainstream publishers that led Moon to co-found White Wind Games with his friend Peter German in 1991. 80% of White Wind sales were to Germany, and all White Wind Games came with German as well as English rules and box text to save on manufacturing costs. The company went on to publish a string of well-received Moon designs, including Elfenroads. In Elfenroads, players race to visit the most cities in a fantasy world by playing cards representing different modes of transportation. Moving on foot, by horse, on a boat, and spending resources. Elfenroads sold very strongly in Germany, and As Elfenland won the Spiel des Jahres in 1998. Also in 1990, Moon inaugurated the Gathering of Friends on the North Shore of Boston to try and spread the gospel of what were still then called German games. The term Euro had yet to be invented. Moon supplemented his income with various jobs, usually as a waiter, and used his passion for games to grow the North Shore Gaming Club, largely through advertisements in The General, his old stomping ground. Moon's reputation kept growing. I'd even read a full-page profile of him in Games Magazine, but I never connected the dots to the fact that I could have looked him up when I went to Boston and Cambridge on that trip I talked about in Episode 2, when I discovered Settlers of Catan. But despite all this success and exposure, Moon's company was still not making money. Even winning the Spiel des Jahres in 1998 basically got Moon out of debt, but no further. It would be another 6 years before he finally struck pay dirt. Moon's design philosophy had coalesced by this point. He liked competitive games where players had interesting choices to make every turn. Not too many choices, two or three. He also had bought into the German games trend of quick turns with very little downtime and as much simultaneous action as possible. Airlines, his first big sale, epitomized this philosophy. It was inspired by the classic Sid Sackson game Acquire from the early 1960s. Saxon, like Francis Tresham, was a man ahead of his time, designing games with far more strategic depth than existed in contemporary tabletop. In airlines, players competed to become majority shareholders in various airline companies. On their turn, players had two choices. One, play a card from their hand to expand their holdings in the company listed on the card, or two, take a card from the table, expanding the route of the listed company, and thereby increasing the value of its shares. The deck was randomly seeded with scoring cards, which gave points to players with majority holdings in the companies. Over the next decade, from 1990 to 2003, Moon kept adapting airlines, always keeping the shareholding and route-laying mechanics, but tinkering with its theme and details. There were Santa Fe and Santa Fe Rails, which mimicked the 18XX tropes of 19th century rail building and share-owning, but set them in the western U.S. There was Union Pacific, also train-themed, but set in a more modern era. And there was Clippers, which transplanted everything to the Pacific Ocean and used sea routes. These games all found audiences, and some were nominated for awards, but none of them broke through. Moon kept at it, though, unwilling or unable to give up on the idea of a stock-based route-laying game. Then, in 2003, Moon was walking along the North Shore in Beverly, Massachusetts, about 40 kilometers north of Boston, when he had his aha moment. Lose the stocks. Simplify. Just focus on claiming the routes. Have players draft cards to claim those routes. Cards and routes would be different colors, not because there were shares or companies or any real reason, just because. It would become a less realistic set collection game like Rummy. Play three of the same color to claim a route that was 3 units long between cities. Players would get points right away depending on how long the route was, but there should be another way to get points. Maybe players were also trying to connect specific cities on the board to earn points. Those cities would be randomly determined somehow, maybe through other cards. And within a few minutes, Moon later said, the whole game was there in his head. He couldn't race home fast enough to start working on it. 90% of that original brainstorm made it into the final version. Moon sent his prototype to 3 publishers, but only one took the bait. It was a relatively new company, having been founded in 2002 by 2 Silicon Valley whiz kids. Mark Kaufman was a software and internet startup marketer. Eric Houtmont founded a company that developed Apple software and also ran his own seed fund. They had this crazy idea that if they could make something people love, people would buy it and share it. They wanted to give people that Christmas morning feeling, that raw feeling of wonder. Hence, the name of their company, Days of Wonder. Kaufman and Houtmont didn't have much trouble raising the $600,000 in seed money they needed from their friends. Tabletop games were already hip with the techie crowd looking for a break from staring at screens and working in isolation. That $600,000 was all they needed. Days of Wonder was profitable within a year, making a name for itself with games that used the German game philosophy of strategy and high-quality components. Days of Wonder had certainly caught Moon's attention, and he brought the prototype of his simplified train game to a pitch meeting. Half an hour later, Moon started packing up, but Houtmont and Kaufman were so into the game they didn't want to stop. That was when they realized they had a potential hit on their hands, and they made him an offer. The game they settled on was our next game changer, Ticket to Ride. How they weren't sued by Apple Records, I don't know, seeing it was the title of a Beatles hit song. In any event, Ticket to Ride was an immediate hit and went on to win 2004's Spiel des Jahres, Germany's Game of the Year, and the ultimate seal of approval in the tabletop world. At the time, Days of Wonder was the youngest company to win that award. Sales skyrocketed, and within the first 6 months, it had sold 100,000 copies at a time when 10,000 copies was considered a solid hit. Within a year, Moon had designed, and Days of Wonder had released, the first expansion, Ticket to Ride Europe. Moon knew that fans wouldn't settle for just another map on another continent. He had to add 1 or 2 twists to the gameplay to keep things fresh, and he did. Players could now build stations in cities which allowed them to ignore part of a route, but still score it at the end of a game. And any stations left over were worth points too. Second, he added special tunnel routes, which added a bit of randomness and risk. Tunnels were not 100% sure things. It was possible to fail to build a route, but players could mitigate that risk by holding cards in reserve in case the original attempt went south. And so it went. The Ticket to Ride game and expansions went on to sell over 3 million copies in its first decade, making it the second biggest selling tabletop franchise after Catan. Moon kept turning, some would say churning, out new Ticket to Ride map expansions. Switzerland, the Nordic countries, Africa, Asia. Some had new kinds of routes, or were designed to be played with just two or three players. Others had passengers who needed to be transported. My favorite expansion is the England-Pennsylvania one, with a double-sided map providing two different play experiences, each in its own way a homage to the game's 18XX ancestors. On the English side, players could buy special technology cards that were essentially permits allowing them to build routes in Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. Other technologies enabled players to build longer routes or two routes in a turn, or break the game's core rules in other ways. The Pennsylvania side, on the other hand, was about stock controlling. Although there was no stock market to manipulate per se, each route enabled the player or players who claimed it to also claim a share of stock in specific companies, and at the end of the game, majority shareholders in each company received bonus points. But the biggest step Days of Wonder took to expand the Ticket to Ride universe was not a physical one, but a digital one. They released a browser-based version of the game very soon after the tabletop version. And although Ticket to Ride was not the first game ported to the iPad when Apple released it in 2010, that honor goes to Small World. Ticket to Ride soon followed, giving Moon's creation an unprecedentedly wide audience. Some people were playing the digital versions up to 40 hours a week, and some players have racked up 100,000 plays of the game since it began. That was a pretty ballsy move, to release a digital version, and somewhat at odds with Days of Wonder's philosophy of creating games that replicated that awesome Christmas morning feeling. Moon, too, was initially leery of letting people play Ticket to Ride for free online. I mean, why give it away when you could sell it? But in fact, sales of the physical game increased 30% after the online version went live, and increased again when the game was ported to iOS and Android. In an interview in Forbes magazine, Kaufman hypothesized that the analog and digital versions of the same game served two distinct purposes for tabletoppers. The physical game was for socializing, and the digital game was for solo play when you were alone or bored. This belief is borne out by the evidence. Whenever Days of Wonder slashes the cost of its apps, 6 to 8 weeks after promotion, there's a bump in sales. Now, it's easy to accuse Alan R. Moon of resting on his Ticket to Ride laurels. Although he's released a handful of other games since 2003, he has spent far more time on the Ticket to Ride empire. And you know what? He spent 20 years barely making a living and finally hit the motherlode. How can you begrudge him that? He's earned it. When I think of Alan R. Moon, I think of Stan Lee, who slogged away writing westerns, romances, horror, and suspense comics until he was 39, and was on the verge of giving up when he was teamed with illustrator Jack Kirby in 1961 and told to come up with a superhero story. They went on to revolutionize the superhero genre with the Fantastic Four, inaugurating what today is called the Silver Age of comic books. Lee was the first to see the potential of building up a fan base of true believers through his editorials. But Lee stopped writing in 1972 when he assumed the role of publisher, and from then, until his death in 2018, he left the writing to others and served as the public face of Marvel Comics, earning well-deserved success and adulation from legions of fans. He also championed the creation of what has come to be called the Marvel Cinematic Universe, bringing superheroes to a wider audience than ever before. All that reminds me of Alan R. Moon. He worked and he worked until he found a successful streamlined formula which continues to connect with a wide audience today. And he championed tabletop as a whole through his Gathering of Friends, which is still going strong after 20 years. So although some tabletop connoisseurs turn their noses up at Ticket to Ride and its many sequels, I am not one of them. However, while many fans credit Ticket to Ride or Catan with sparking their interest in tabletop, eventually, some of them couldn't help looking around for games that provided something more. Games with more meat on their bones, games that simulated actual historical events. Most had no idea that there already was a 30-year-old hobby based on games exactly like that. I knew, of course. I'd been playing those games since 1978. Some of them had 30-page rule books and took hours to play. They were incredibly detailed and immersive, and most were at heart still using design ideas inherited from the first generation of war games, which had emerged in the late 1950s. Hex grids for maps, cardboard chits for pieces, I-go-you-go movement and attack phases, perfect information, dice-driven combat. What was needed now was a hybrid of dense conflict simulation and modern Euro, a war game that was willing to sacrifice some hyper-precision while still giving players the experience of sitting in the command chair. Some war game designers, I'm thinking of John Hill, John Butterfield, Joe Miranda, Ty Bomba, they had pushed the envelope with elegant innovations, but now it was time for two designers influenced by both the war game and the Euro worlds to create a game that would not only top the charts for years, but also become a teaching tool for diplomats and soldiers. That was part two of episode four of The Game Changers. I'm David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement. Thanks for listening. See you next time, and don't flip that table.